Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining me on this session where we're going to compare and contrast Hyper-V to VMware. I'm Simon Perryman, a technical evangelist with Microsoft Corp, and I'm also a VMware certified professional so that I can really try to understand the different technologies and make educated comparisons. Now, before we get started, I'd like to ask by a show of hands, who is currently a VMware customer? Okay, everybody in the room, great. So my next question, who here is using Hyper-V in production? About half, two-thirds of you, pretty good. And who here is just evaluating Hyper-V? A couple of you as well. All right, great, great. So it sounds like we've got a lot of VMware people in the room, a few Hyper-V people. I guess there's going to be a lot of crossover there. Great. So what we're going to look at today is kind of four key areas comparing and contrasting our different technologies. Now, the goal of this, I'm not here to go and tell you that Hyper-V is better than VMware. What I'm trying to do here is show you technical comparisons, feature differentiators, and just different ways that we kind of approach the same technical problems. From a feature-by-feature level, we're pretty much equal now. Certainly in the past, VMware was far ahead of us, but with each subsequent release of Windows Server, we'd be getting closer. And in many cases, we're now Hyper-V is now actually leading the charge. We're creating features that VMware is now following us with. So we want to get past this kind of feature-by-feature comparison between our two companies and really kind of look at some other benefits. Now, I am in kind of a marketing role, but I will stay completely away from cost argument, okay? I will promise you that. I'm not here to tell you which company is cheaper, though we all know who is. So let's get started. And first, we're going to talk about scalability and performance. So this is looking at running large virtual machines. Next, we're going to look at security and multi-tenancy, meaning ways that we can isolate different individuals running on a host. We're then going to look at how we can make our infrastructure mobile and flexible, and finally, high availability and resiliency. Now, as part of this demo, we are currently comparing Windows Server 2012 R2 against vSphere 5.1. Now, I know that vSphere 5.5 has been announced recently, so wherever I can, I will try to update that, include that comparison there. And if anybody has questions in the audience, although it's kind of tough for me to see, I will take questions at least initially. So I think these questions are things that other people will have. So I really want to have, you know, a true discussion about how these two technologies compare. So if you have your hand raised and I don't see you because of the bright lights, just you know, say Simon, something like that, and that'll hopefully get my attention. So let's get started by talking about scalability and performance. So this is comparing our old version of Hyper-V to our new version, just as first map. And you can see that over our past releases, we really have tried to increase all of our scalability numbers, coming up with the largest computers, most amount of memory, largest clusters, most VMs in a cluster, and Hyper-V is still leading in many of these numbers. Now, if you actually have a workload that does not meet the scale needs of Windows Server 2012 R2, please come and speak with me afterwards. I've given this offer out in several sessions already, but I still haven't found anybody that has a VM or an application that we're not meeting these scale needs. So if you really do, I would love to hear it. I'd love to learn more about it, because we're continuing to try to increase these limits as well. And a lot of it really comes down to just testing cost. You know, it's expensive for our internal teams to buy this latest and greatest hardware as well. So we are always trying to advance. So please, send me the feedback. I'd love to hear if we can't meet your scale numbers. Now, as we kind of look at VMware, you can see that we're pretty equal in many of these areas. In some cases, Hyper-V is actually further ahead. I don't think there's a single case here, though, where Hyper-V is trailing in what we can do for memory, storage, any of these other kind of scale requirements. Now, this presentation, I should also add, will be available for download. It will be available online. So if you want to get more information about it, please download it. We do include references to all of these numbers and everything. So as part of this presentation, we are trying to be as factual as possible here. And so again, with our sum notes, we include all of these references for all of the data as well. So next thing that we really focused on with this release was improving our storage capabilities. First thing we added was virtual fiber channel for our virtual machine guests. And this is something that VMware's had for a while, so this is something where we're trying to catch up on. And having a virtual fiber channel adapter basically means your virtual machine can talk to fiber channel arrays. Now, in the past, we supported iSCSI, fiber channel over Ethernet, and we now support SMB. But we had so many customers using fiber channel as the fastest arrays, we realized it was critical in this release to make sure we support this as well. So Windows Server comes with built-in HBAs, fully virtualized, and this also allows you to do guest clustering connected to fiber channel. We also support live migration with those VMs that are connected to the fiber channel as well. So you do have the ability to keep using that mobility, move your VMs around without losing connection to your storage. The next big change that came in 2012 was native 4K disk support. Previously, Microsoft's VHD file type was using 512 bytes instead of 4K bytes. And what this really means is we work faster now. A lot of older, less compatible programs still expected 512. We've now upped it to what's kind of the industry standard. And this basically means our block sizes are sent in 4K bits. Now, previously, we kind of kept them smaller at 512 because if you had lots of retries, it was easier to retry a smaller bit of data if you had to resend it. Now we supported slightly larger ones, but because our network connectivity is so fast, everyone's using 1 gigi, 10 gigi, this need to, you know, retry in case a packet is dropped doesn't really impact us anymore. So we've bumped up and moved up to industry standard 4K block sizes. Next, we increased the size of our actual VHDs, our virtual hard disks. These would be equivalent to your VMDK files. And actually, VMware just announced in 5.5, they're going to support 62 terabyte sizes. So we beat them by just a little bit still. Now, with our larger 64K VHD sizes, 64 terabyte VHD sizes, this means that, you know, the actual storage device you can use for your VM is really highly scalable. And again, if you have applications that are using more than 64 terabytes, I'd love to hear more about it so we can consider continuing to increase our amounts. And then finally, we've just added with the 2012 R2 release the ability to resize our disks online. Now, what VMware does, and how we're kind of slightly different here, is they have the ability to hot add disks. So you could add additional disks without any downtime to the VM. We wanted to make it a little better. We wanted to give you the ability to actually expand and contract fixed size disks. And so just to be very clear, these are disks that you pre-allocate a terabyte. These are not dynamically expanding disks, or in VMware terms, thinly provisioned disks. This is a fixed size disk. Could go into disk management, increase it, decrease it, and freely adjust it. But we're not done. We wanted to make it easier to go and deploy these VMs. So we can now boot from USB disks. So you have a thumb drive, go into the data center, plug it into your host. We can now boot the VM from those drives. So it gives you a little more mobility, kind of useful for our IT admins. We've added support for offloaded data transfer, also known as ODX. And offloaded data transfer basically means that we can do much faster file copies as long as your hardware supports it. Now, with a traditional file copy from one storage array to another, or this could be something like a deployment from your library server over to your Hyper-V host, well, the way that it works is the actual computer which is requesting that copy actually takes the information through the network, stores it in memory, pushes it out the network, down to the other storage array. And so the downside of this is it's filling your network, and also it's causing a performance overhead for that host that's actually doing the processing. What we could do with ODX support is basically tell array one directly talk to array two through your storage fabric. Don't send anything through the network. Don't use this computer as this intermediary that's copying the data in the memory. And so this increases deployment times by sometimes 10 times. Now, in some cases, there isn't even copying that has to happen between the storage arrays. These arrays are intelligent. They can just redirect the actual pointers, the locations in their disk mapping, to the new storage. So sometimes you can do deployments or file copies in a matter of milliseconds. Now, it's important to know that this capability, ODX support, it actually has to be built into the hardware. So if you have old storage hardware, you're not going to be able to make it ODX capable. It's actually when you acquire it, that's going to be one of the features provided by your storage vendor. So definitely something we want to encourage our customers to think about as they purchase new storage. Does it have ODX capabilities? So this is going to speed up deployment time, file copy time, transfer time, and just make it easier for you as an admin while not blocking your network. We then added a type of storage virtualization with Windows Server 2012 known as storage spaces. Storage spaces basically lets you take a bunch of individual disks, commodity hardware, and create a pool. And so by a pool, I'm talking about you have 10 1 terabyte disks. You create just a pool of 10 terabytes. Now, within that pool, you're going to do things such as RAID, parity bits, mirroring. So you may not have, you know, the full 10 terabytes of storage. But when we're managing that as a large block, a large logical unit, all we have to do to go and provision a new LUN is say, I want a new virtual disk within my pool. It could be even larger than 1 terabyte, even though those original disks were smaller. What we're doing is basically adding a virtualized layer on top of the storage. And so we've been working with all of the major hardware vendors, Dell, Fujitsu, NEC, NetApp, EMC, and basically work, their APIs are directly built into storage spaces. And so what this means is, you as an admin just speak to Windows Server. You just speak to the storage spaces and say, I want this. What happens under the covers is we actually do a translation. We take that API, we have our own storage management API called SMAPI, SM API, and that API will actually translate that to EMC or to Dell or to NEC's specific APIs. And so what this means for you is it can reduce your cost of storage hardware. You no longer have to be tied into a single vendor. Just because you've been using EMC in the past doesn't mean you have to continue using them. You can get this cheaper hardware. You can mix and match the vendors. And it doesn't really require additional training for your staff beyond understanding storage spaces. Because again, once you have this, we handle all of those translations to all the different storage arrays seamlessly from you. So taking a look at how we compare to VMware here. VMware has virtual fiber channel support. That's something that was a big request for us with this release. We made it. They have third-party multipathing support, so being able to have multiple channels directly to your storage. No native 4K disk support yet. The largest virtual disk size, well, they just announced, 62 terabytes coming in version 5.5. Online disk resize, we have the ability to not only grow it, but also shrink it. Maximum size of pass-through disks, and a pass-through disk is basically a way to connect your VM to your storage array without having to pass it through the hypervisor layer. We support that, but VMware, we all support that. We have slightly larger disks. We have offload data transfer support for free. You need VAAI to have it with VMware. We both support boot from USB. And we also have tiered storage pooling. Now, tiered storage was something we just announced in 2012 R2. And with tiered storage, we basically have the ability to take these storage spaces and give them different priorities based on their speed. And so you could kind of think of this as almost like caching with memory. You're going to have a pool of fast disks, which will generally be SSD. They're going to be fast. They're going to be using the most commonly used data. You then have a pool of medium speed, which might be traditional spinning disks. You then might have a pool of slow disks, and these might be something like a tape drive or some older hardware. And with our storage tiering, we can pass this information between the slow disks, the medium disks, and the fast disks as you need it, with the intention of really optimizing the speed of your storage transfer. Now, most storage vendors, they actually have their own tiered solutions. They cost a lot of extra money. We're providing this free in box with Windows Server 2012. And you could do this with commodity hardware, and you can mix and match vendors. So we've made a lot of investments around our storage management, storage virtualization, to try to drive down costs, add simplicity at the management layer. So let's talk about enhanced resource management next. So this is how we go and monitor the usage of our different resources, our storage, network, and virtual machines. So first of all, we've had a feature since 2008 R2 called dynamic memory. And basically, what dynamic memory does is allow you to have more memory allocated to a host than there really is. Now, VMware does this. They have a feature similar to this, and they use what's called page sharing. Basically, they'll find similar pages in memory. If multiple VMs are using the same page, they'll have better density by basically pointing to that same page. So you can think of something like, hey, every version of Windows Server has Server Manager. So that piece of Server Manager in memory could be shared by multiple VMs. This kind of allows us to build up and consolidate. So we have a similar solution, but we've actually decided to go and implement our usage of dynamic memory slightly differently, because we're trying to always maximize memory usage on a host. Now, what you're going to see when you go and deploy a new virtual machine through Hyper-V is you have the option to have either a you have the option with dynamic memory to basically provide a startup memory, a minimum running memory, and a maximum running memory, if you want. Now, by default, we set the maximum to, I believe it's 1 terabyte, which is the maximum amount of memory we can have for any VM. And even if your host doesn't support that, that's okay. You're not going to get an error. Now, the reason why our default is 1 terabyte, as much as we can possibly support, is every time we deploy a VM on a host, we're going to try to maximize the amount of memory. So if you have dynamic memory and you deploy a VM to a host that's empty, let's say that host has 100 gigabytes of free memory, that virtual machine only needs 10 gigabytes, it's still going to take up the 400. It's going to use as much of the resources as possible, so it runs as fast as possible. When you go and add a second VM to that host, it'll drop from 100 to maybe 50-50, add a third, and it's going to constantly adjust. But the objective with dynamic memory is to use as much of that host memory as possible. Even if your service only requires 10, if we give it 100, it's going to be really, really fast in the meantime. And that's our goal, to make the most use of our hardware. Now, it's constantly monitoring its use, the other VMs on that same host. And so if you have VMs that are ranked to higher priority, there's not enough memory left, we could turn off low priority VMs. You get to reserve a minimum memory buffer for your host so that the host never gets overwhelmed. The host always has free memory. And then you can assign memory weights to each of the VMs. So basically, if two VMs both require 10 gigs, you assign one with greater weight, it's going to try to take even more. So we're trying to be intelligent with our memory management, always try to maximize. The next enhancement we added was resource metering. And resource metering just gives us better understanding of how our actual VMs are being used. Now, we could break this down to the individual user, an individual virtual machine. And we look at things such as IOPS per second, network traffic per second, memory usage, CPU usage, and we're always constantly collecting this data and saving it. Now, this means if you have a problem, or you've got a particular VM that's being overwhelmed, you can immediately look at the historical data. There's no need to do something like turn on perfmon, repro a problem, and then go look at the data later. We're always keeping track of this down to the per user level. Now, with 2012, we added network quality of service, also known as QoS. Quality of service means that we can ensure a guaranteed amount of network for a particular VM. Now, the problem that we had in the past was you might have a host that has 10 virtual machines. One of those VMs is using up all of the network traffic. They're all going to a single switch or a team set of switches. But that one VM that's using up all the network traffic, that can negatively impact those other VMs on the host. So we want to be respectful and make sure that each of these has an equal opportunity to get the amount of network traffic. So with quality of service, we can allocate a minimum guaranteed amount of network traffic and a maximum possible amount of network traffic. This means that that VM is always going to get some amount of network traffic within that range. This way, you're never going to over-allocate. VMs are never going to be starved from being able to use the network. In 2012 R2, we've now released storage quality of service. Same principle, minimums, maximums for your actual connection to the storage. We base that on the IOPS. So you could, again, allocate and ensure that certain VMs always have access to your SAN, always get a minimum amount of running memory. Now, we've had some customers in our pre-release programs actually be able to use these two metrics to go and find unused VMs in their environment. You know, one of the challenges that we've seen with the growth of virtualization is VM sprawl, where people think VMs are free, they go deploy them, forget about them, and then they're still consuming resources. Now, it's tough for an administrator to really know, hey, is this VM being used or not, without it going into the VM, maybe taking a look at login information, things like that. So what you could do with the minimum, maximum quality of service and resource metering is just take a look at the traffic that that VM is doing. If it's always staying on its minimum or zero for storage and or networking, you know that that VM is probably not going to be used. You can look at the historical data from the resource metering. And then you have the ability to go and follow up with the owner of that VM. Ask them if you can take it back, free up those resources, reuse them in your data center. So taking a look at how we compare to VMware, pretty equal. VMware has all of these features. They've had them for a while, so it was important for Microsoft to go catch up. And so we are now feature equivalent with our resource metering, quality of service, and our dynamic memory. So let's move on and talk about security and multi-tenancy. Now, first thing that we wanted to introduce with this release of 2012 was have an extensible switch. Big customer complaint with our first couple releases of Hyper-V. And by an extensible switch, this means that third parties can go and plug into that switch. Now remember, this is a virtual switch, something that sits on the host. It's not a physical piece of equipment. Remember, if you kind of think of like the network traffic for a virtual machine, it goes in through the physical adapter, then it goes up to the virtual switch, and the virtual switch might go and send it off to the different VMs. Now the challenge was, we had partners like Cisco, Inmon, Five9 that have these switch extensions, things such as packet forwarders, ingress and egress monitoring, performance monitoring, and they couldn't really speak to this Hyper-V switch, so they didn't really know what was happening there. So with the extensible switch, we've basically made it open, provided APIs that our storage vendors can use to go plug in, send traffic out, analyze it, send it back directly to the switch. Now, we wanted to continue to extend the switch as well, so we added even more features in 2012 R2. And so what's going to happen with our switch? Continuing to grow it, continuing to improve it. And several of the partner solutions are already available for 2012. So Cisco, NEC, Five9, Inmon, already supporting the latest version. Now, as we go take a look at our VMware comparison, VMware has something similar. They have their distributed vSwitch. Sorry. The V distributed switch, VDS. And with a switch, they can go and forward things to partners. There are some limitations, though. So as I go through everything else here, everything else more or less can do. So you can see we're actually, in some cases, trying to go a little further, trying to make this more extensible. And one of Microsoft's big plays to really try to learn more about VMware, get some more VMware customers, is our integration story. So Microsoft being the biggest software vendor in the world, we're trying to use that to our advantage, working with every hardware partner, every software partner, so that we can really try to make sure that we integrate no matter what you're using. And you're going to see that with products such as System Center. System Center Virtual Machine Manager allows you to manage vSphere environments. Operations Manager allows you to monitor them. Orchestrator allows you to automate, do deployment, take input, perform actions, provide output back to vCenter. So we're really trying to, you know, position System Center as a broader management tool. And so as people are kind of thinking about the switch from VMware over to Hyper-V, we want to remind people that it can be done gradually. It's not something that you're going to do overnight. It's a transition. And System Center can help you during that transition by providing a single management solution for both ESX and your Hyper-V environments. And so as you start to think about, you know, new investments, if you are looking at Hyper-V, those are the best things to really start moving to Hyper-V. If you have really good, well-working systems, there's always a risk of, you know, switching over from hypervisors. So most of the customers we speak to, their migration strategy is new projects, new investments, Hyper-V. Keep maintaining VMware until we need to do a new refresh cycle. So taking a look at networking performance now. We've added four main networking performance enhancements in this release. So the first one is Dynamic VMQ, Dynamic Virtual Machine Queue. So what we basically do with VMQ is we could go and split the processing of network traffic across different CPUs. Now with traditional VMQ, it hits a single CPU. That could overwhelm the CPU and that can form a bottleneck. What we're trying to do with our new Dynamic VMQ is basically look at which processes are currently being used and go and start pushing this network traffic, this virtual network traffic, to the processes that have the lowest utilization. If those spike, we'll push it to a different processor. So we're constantly monitoring the use of this processor, trying to optimize how we push our network traffic through. Next, we have IPsec task offload. So what happens with IPsec? IPsec is one of our encryption methods as we send communication between the networks. Now, when you encrypt something, that takes some CPU cycles, send it over. You decrypt it. That also takes some CPU cycles. So what we're trying to do is take away these CPU cycles from the actual processor themselves and place those cycles on the network card. So many network cards you're going to see today support IPsec task offload. This means as soon as the network card receives it, it can decrypt it itself rather than passing that to the processor. This way you're freeing up clock cycles for your actual CPU. Now, the next enhancement we have is virtual receive side scaling, RSS. Now, receive side scaling basically means that as we go and push information out, or as we receive it, we could go break it across different processes as well, different virtual processes. Slightly different than dynamic VMQ that uses the physical processes. So again, we're trying to take advantage of splitting up traffic, breaking it across multiple physical or virtual processes whenever we can. And then finally, we have SRIOV, Secure Receive IO Virtualization here. And basically, what we're able to do with SRIOV is connect the actual networking card, the physical adapter, directly to the virtual machine. And what this means is we're basically bypassing that translation layer through the VM bus, through the hypervisor, through the virtual network to the VM. So this means that we can get faster networking traffic. Our VMs are now talking directly to our physical external switches. So faster input, faster output. Now you actually need to buy network cards that support SRIOV. It doesn't come in box. It's actually a hardware feature on your NIC. But we encourage our customers that are looking at virtualization to definitely consider this. It's going to improve performance. So as you kind of look across all of these, you can see that there's almost two different options you can go. We can add more traffic to the NIC or more processing to the NIC, or we can add more processing to the CPU. So it kind of gives you a bit of a balance based on where your own bottlenecks are. Now, we also added BitLocker drive encryption throughout our stack as well, covering all of our different products. Now, BitLocker is what you may be familiar with your laptop. It protects the laptop, it encrypts it, so even if the laptop gets stolen, somebody puts a new operating system on it with their own password, they're still not ever going to be able to see the data. Now, we started to hear these customers, especially around the credit card industry, of actual break-ins to the physical data center, where storage arrays were actually being lifted out of data centers, stolen. And so we wanted to make sure that we can protect against that as well. So we now have BitLocker drive encryption across all of our servers, including direct attached storage, SANs, cluster shared volumes. So when you have a clustered one with a shared storage, that would be equivalent to VMFS, or VMHA as well. And then Windows Server file share clusters as well, and file servers. So we're really trying to protect everything. Any type of share, any type of storage is going to be protected from physical theft as well. So as we kind of take a look at how we compare to VMware, we actually think we're ahead in a lot of these integration pieces. And I think a lot of that comes from our strength of working so well with all of our different hardware partners. VMware, they have nice partnerships with Cisco and EMC. At least right now, we're not sure how vSAN and NSX are going to affect them. But at least right now, they're really focused on those partnerships with those other companies. But as you can see here, you know, we're providing these features, working with these hardware vendors, staying on top of the latest and greatest hardware innovations, and making sure that we can take advantage of them from our servers as well. So next thing, we wanted to increase our support more broadly, provide a flexible infrastructure, let people do with their VMs what they want. So we've worked a lot on our Linux integration. We've built a team up within the Windows Server and System Center engineering team that's fully dedicated to Linux integration and support. We have program managers, we have developers, we have testers that came from Linux backgrounds, that came from Red Hat, that came from Sun, that are these deep technical Linux experts. And their full job is making Linux work better on the Microsoft platform. Now, one of their biggest achievements they've made recently is actually including Hyper-V components within the Linux kernel. Now, specifically, they added the Hyper-V integration components. This would be equivalent to VM tools. Basically, it's what makes the virtual machine know it's a virtual machine. We call it an enlightened virtual machine. And so this means that the host can interact with that VM. It can start it, it can stop it, It can do checkpoints. It supports live migration. It supports backup and item level restore. It's basically making it a first-class citizen of the hypervisor. And so this is our big investment with Linux, supporting all these different distributions. And this includes Ubuntu, CentOS, SUSE, Red Hat, all of these main different Linux distributions. Now, we also wanted to make troubleshooting our virtual machines a little easier as well. And we do this through live virtual machine cloning. If you have an in-production system that's maybe slow, not functioning as good as it should be, oftentimes it can be more disruptive to troubleshoot it than to just let it keep running badly. So we wanted to fix this problem. We wanted to give the ability to clone a live running virtual machine. Take it, export it, bring it back up on a different host, and then you can start debugging it without impacting the original running VM. Now, the important thing here is we make sure that when we take this live snapshot, that all of the memory is in a consistent state. What I mean by that, it's not corrupt. All the memory bits and blocks that are needed, that are referenced, are there. So you're never going to start it up and say, unable to start, corruption, anything like that. So hopefully, this is going to help people as they troubleshoot. Our user exports the running VM. They export it. They power it back on. They fix it. And then they can even, once they've fixed it, as long as they update the name, update the networking, they can turn off that bad, faulty live VM, turn on this good VM, or the one that they've fixed, and then redirect clients. So you can almost do kind of like a replace, a hot swap after you've gone and tested it. Virtual machine mobility was something that we continue to try to improve as well. So live migration is our equivalent to vMotion. We copy in-state running memory from one host to another host. Once we've got two versions that are running identically, we redirect the clients from the first to the second, and we basically move that live client environment between different hosts, no impact to the client, no impact to the virtual machine. So we had live migration for a while, since 2008 R2. The VMware were ahead of us here. They had this feature called storage live migration, so we wanted to make sure that we added support for that as well. With storage live migration, you can move the actual VHD or VHDX file, the storage file, that would be equivalent to your VMDK file, with zero downtime to the VM. So move it from one storage array to another. And if you include ODX, offload data transfer, you can often do that in a matter of seconds. So a lot of customers are using this when they do things like maintenance or troubleshooting. They have a cluster that's up and running. The VMs are on this clustered disk. There might be 20 VMs on a single disk. And so taking that disk offline for troubleshooting or repair can be disruptive. But if you storage live migrate all the VHDs to another array temporarily, you could fix the disk, repair it, revalidate it, retest it. Once it's up and working again, storage live migrate everything back. Zero downtime to the VMs, yet you've gone and fixed the underlying storage. But we even went a step further, and we did something before VMware did, and that's shared nothing live migration. What we can do with shared nothing live migration is simultaneously move our VM and our storage from one host to another, zero downtime to the VM. We can move them between clusters, from one host to a cluster to a single host. So as long as you have a SMB network connection between the two VMs, we have this flexibility to go and move these around dynamically. VMware since introduced this. I believe they did it in 5.1. Now, we wanted to make it easier for us to upgrade our systems as well. As you may have noticed, Microsoft's release cycle is increasing the frequency. We're now going to be coming out with major additions every 1 to 2 years, minor additions every 6 months or so. And so as we continue to innovate, continue to release these newer products, we want to make it easier for our customers to stay on top, to keep moving up to the latest version. So we're now going to be supporting live migration to the newest version. This means that if you have hosts running 2012, you go set up your 2012 R2 hosts, and you just simply live migrate them up. The VMs stay online, customers stay online, you've moved them to the latest version with no impact to any running applications. Now, there is one kind of challenge to this, one kind of caveat here. At some point, you need to upgrade the integration components, the VM tools that are running inside the VM. There is no urgency to do this. Everything will work. But if you want to take advantage of the latest Hyper-V innovations, We have a new enhanced desktop mode where we can basically, through the VM connection window, copy and paste between our host and our VMs, large files. We could go and resize that VM connection window. You can redirect printers, redirect drives, redirect smart cards, redirect sound. Basically, if you want to take advantage of this next wave of VM integration between the host and the guest, that's when you're going to want to upgrade the integration components. So what we recommend our customers do is live migrate, let everything run. Next time you need to do a reboot anyway for that VM or that service, maybe during your patching cycle, that's when you should go and upgrade the integration components. So as you kind of do this migration, we are going to avoid downtime. At some point, you'll need a reboot, but you can kind of do that at your own terms. So network virtualization. We talked about storage virtualization already. Storage virtualization simplifies our ability to go and manage our storage. Network virtualization is the same concept. It's simplifying our underlying topology, the different subnets, the different data centers, the different VLANs, and allowing you to manage it in just much easier terms as a single logical network or a group of networks. Now, the way you actually go and configure this is you basically have to define what your current network structure is. So you're going to create what is called a logical network. Within that logical network, you define what that means. So the IP address range, the subnets, IP addresses that are currently being used, ones that should not be used, DNS servers, DHCP server, default gateway. So basically, you kind of define what this current network looks like, and then you just give it an easy name, my network. Now, what this means you can do is, in your future deployments, you can just refer to this infrastructure as my network. So next time you deploy a VM, you don't have to worry about where it's being deployed, what IP addresses it should use, whether they're free or not. You just say deploy it to my network, and it's going to stay within that network. Stay isolated, stay on that subnet. So our goal here is just, again, to simplify this management, take things a step up, manage things at a theoretical level rather than going down to the details of IP address management. So we also, when we started doing network virtualization, we had a challenge from a lot of our customers. When we were creating these isolated networks, things would work well for them, in theory, when they were running on this isolated network. But they came into this problem of speaking back to their corporate resources, their outside world. So if you think about deploying a private network for somebody, when would you want to do that? Well, a great example is if you work with developers. They might need to go deploy a lot of VMs. They might need to set up their own Active Directory infrastructure for testing. They might want to go and set up their own DHCP server so they can get easy IP addresses within that private network. Well, that's great because they can operate freely. And Microsoft actually does this for all of its employees. We get private networks so I can go create as many VMs as I want. I could deploy my own AD, my own infrastructure service, and not impact the rest of the world. But the problem is sometimes you need access to corporate resources. Maybe you need access to a file share. Maybe you need to authenticate something in AD. And so currently, being able to go from this private network to this corporate network is a challenge. You have to add new virtual networks, configure VLANs, and basically connect them through a unique connection. So we wanted to really try to simplify this. And so there's a networking component that's been around for a little while that's provided by Cisco, some other third-party companies, called a Network Virtualization Gateway. More specifically, NVGRE, Network Virtualization Generic Resource Encapsulation Gateway. And what that basically means is it goes and uses a GRE type of networking algorithm to basically go and tag incoming and outgoing network traffic. So if you kind of look at this IP address range, this tag, generally with an IP address, you're going to get information such as what's the IP address, the destination, the host, MAC address information, but we now also add this GRE key, this tag to each of these IP address packets. And what this tag does is it allows us to take requests from our private network, goes through this gateway, the gateway adds a tag, sends it out to corporate resources, you get back whatever you need, sends it back, and it's going to include that same tag on it. And based on that tag that we're sending back and forth through the gateway, it allows us to go and identify the resources on our private network. So think of this as almost a buffer between this crazy, crazy world for your developers and then the real world that you have to manage, providing you with security and isolation. Now, Virtual Machine Manager 2012 R2 actually includes an NVGRE gateway inbox for free. It's a virtual machine, and so you say, I want to go configure my virtual networks. I want to go and deploy this NVGRE gateway. You could create this in a service template, and we will actually build you a virtualized gateway that you can go run on one of your hosts, and that will do all of this translation for you. So you don't need to go out, buy a separate component, work with a third-party built-in box. Oh, sorry, I almost jumped ahead here. Here's more kind of a better visualization of this gateway, being able to kind of go between these different clouds. So let's take a look at how we compare with VMware here. Well, VMware, of course, supports vMotion, our equivalent to live migration. But now we've also added two new features for live migration with 2012 R2. Live migration with compression, live migration with RDMA. Now, I'm going to kind of assume that most people saw the keynote here. One of the demos I did during the keynote was live migration using these different methods. Now, traditional live migration in our demo took about a minute and a half. Then we did live migration with compression. And what we're doing with live migration with compression is first we copy over our configuration file, just like normal. But then the actual memory that we're copying, we compress it with a quick algorithm. Send it over. On the other side, decompress it. So the trade-off here is there's a little more processing that happens on both servers because you've got to compress, decompress, but the time it takes to transfer that data is reduced by about 2 to 3 times. So I think in the demo we did on stage, we went from about a minute and a half to about 40 seconds when we did live migration with compression. And then we went a step further and figured we can do live migration over RDMA. Now, RDMA is Remote Direct Memory Access. Basically, what this means is one host can directly place bits into the memory of the other host. This is what enables us to do a live migration in about 10 seconds instead of 90 seconds. Now, specifically, what happens with traditional live migration? When you copy memory from one host over to the second host actually has to read the data, it processes it, it goes through the kernel, and then the host will write it into its own memory. But it's this processing over here that takes the additional time. What we're doing here is before we start the live migration, we're asking the second host, where is your free memory? The second host tells us, you're going to take these memory blocks, and we will then directly put them inside those memory blocks without having to pass it through this other server, without having to pass it through the kernel. And that's what enables us to do 10-second live migrations with production workloads. And you can see that VMware don't quite have these yet, but we definitely suspect that they'll be coming sometime in the near future. We've added support for simultaneous live migrations as well, being able to do multiple live migrations at once. VMware supports this, but they have some limitations on how many they let you. We have an unlimited number of live migrations and an unlimited number of storage live migrations. It's really going to depend on what type of workloads you're running. We also have automatic live migrations based on the current load, so you know, balancing traffic across different hosts. We have what we call dynamic optimization and performance and resource optimization on our side. VMware has distributed resource scheduling, DRS. Basically do the same thing, monitor the host utilization, distribute the VMs so they stay balanced across them. You can do that based on power, based on load. Actually, let me talk about the power one for a little bit. So we have power management as well built in. And what we can basically do is if we find that a host is being underutilized, we'll just turn it off. Save power, save money, save cooling costs. VMware also supports this through their distributed power management, so kind of equivalent features here, you know, just trying to use the best of our technologies. Live storage migration we both support. Shared nothing live migration we support with VMware just coming out that with Essentials Plus and higher editions of vSphere 5.1. Some other features to talk about here, live VM cloning. Both of us can do that. Live migration updates, both of us can do that. Network virtualization and the NVGRE gateway, we can do that. However, you still need the vCloud network security product if you're doing it with VMware. So VMware is going to charge a little bit extra to be able to do that. We're providing this in box. Now let's move on and talk about high availability and resiliency, keeping our applications and services up and running. So our primary high availability solution is known as failover clustering. It'd be equivalent to VMHA. Basically have the multiple servers, they connect to some type of shared storage. You could do vMotion, live migrate between the different hosts. Where we've made improvements with this release is we support the largest clusters and the most number of VMs. We have 64 node clusters, 8,000 virtual machines a cluster. You can actually have over 1,000 VMs on each of the different hosts. We've improved our cluster shared volumes, which is our file system for distributed VM access. It would be equivalent to VMFS. So we're pretty much on par with this kind of shared storage, these core clustering capabilities. Now, we also wanted to adjust our membership model in this release. So I'm not going to go into too much detail on this. If you want the detail of these failover clustering improvements, come to my session tomorrow. We're going to go through all of them. But we basically make it easier to adjust the number of members that are in a cluster. So if a server crashes, too many servers crash, it's not going to turn off the other nodes. We're going to do whatever we can to keep all of our nodes, all of our VMs online. We have the ability to drain roles and put nodes into maintenance mode. So you can multi-select a lot of VMs, say, move to the best possible node, and we can just go and drain that host. But the best possible node is kind of a cool feature which we built into clustering. And what this means is anytime you want to go and move a VM to a different host, we're going to actually be proactively monitoring the free memory on every single one of your hosts. Because that's the metric that most admins want to do. If they're going to move a VM somewhere, they want to move it to the host with the most free memory. We're going to make that easy for you. We will automatically move it to the host with the most free memory for you. Now, if you want to have the ability to pick a specific host, you can, of course, do that as well. But just trying to simplify the administration. We also have an ability to drain our host when we shut down a VM. Sorry, when we shut down a host. Let me try that one again. We have the ability to drain our VMs when we shut down a host. So what this means is if you have multiple admins using the same server, you might have an admin that just doesn't realize there's VMs running. He patches, he reboots, kills those VMs. So we have protection in that now actually built in our shutdown mechanism of Windows Server. When you click shutdown and there's running virtual machines, it's going to alert the other admins there's VMs, and it's going to wait and live migrate them off that host, giving you the opportunity to make sure that your VMs always stay up and running. They stay safe. Now with guest clustering, this is kind of abstracting our high availability solution. And instead of doing clustering on the physical level, where we move VMs between the physical hosts, we do clustering on the virtual level, where we basically have a VM. It has Windows Server installed in the VM. And those two VMs form a cluster. We call this a guest cluster. So the benefits of guest clustering are things such as patching. If you need to patch your VM, instead of having to shut down the service, reboot it after the patch, bring it back online, we can just fail over that service between the two different virtual cluster nodes. It's also going to make sure that services are monitored. So if a SQL service crashes in a VM, we'll automatically restart it. So it kind of gives you a lot of these benefits of traditional clustering, but inside this virtual level. Now, we support live migration as well. So if you move your VMs around, the guest cluster still stays alive. So remember, you're moving that virtualized cluster node around. It still stays online. Now, we also still require shared storage. Anytime you have a cluster, regardless of whether it's a VMware cluster or a Microsoft cluster, we need to have a centralized store of information. The reason for this is if we have a VM that's running on node 1 and it crashes, it moves over to node 2, we want to make sure that it can still access the data it was using, its VHD or its VMDK disk. This is why we need a single location that both nodes can read. If you had the data on direct attached storage on a host, that host crashed, you no longer have access to the data. So shared storage is always going to be a requirement when we have these high availability systems. Now with guest clustering, we support iSCSI, Fiber Channel over Ethernet, and now Virtual Fiber Channel, and also SMB. So you have lots of different options how you can actually store your data between these two virtualized cluster nodes. We also have features that allow you to change the priority of your VM. It allows you to go and keep VMs together or force them to be separated across different hosts. Affinity, and anti-affinity. And now with the R2 release, we added a new feature, a new storage option called a shared VHDX file. So basically, what you would do traditionally with a guest cluster is you set up your two virtual cluster nodes, and you still have to go and pick a storage array or a LAN, pick a SAN, again, fiber channel, iSCSI, fiber channel over Ethernet. But the challenge that we had with a lot of hosters, a lot of large companies, is they didn't really like exposing this storage infrastructure to their end user. Their end user wanted to build an application in the virtualized world, and they shouldn't really have access to the underlying SAN or know how that's laid out. So what we can do now is we can create a VHDX file, which should be equivalent to a VMDK file. Just give it, say, a terabyte, an empty disk, and we can actually attach that to our two virtual machines and use that file, that disk, as our shared storage. So let's say you're running SQL in two virtual machines. You have a virtualized SQL cluster. Well, the SQL database would actually be stored on that shared VHDX file. The users go deploy their cluster, they point to the file, connect it, and they then start using their application data on that shared file. Now, that shared file can run across all different types of actual storage fabric. You know, if you have fiber channel under the covers, LANs, it doesn't matter, we don't care. It gets abstracted. So it's almost like a storage management virtualization as well, just yet on another layer. So priority, affinity, and anti-affinity. So prioritization was actually one of the biggest requests we had in the 2012 release, being able to rank your virtual machines. Say I have VMs that are high important, medium, low, and even VMs that we don't really care about if they crash. It's actually a fourth option that we call don't auto-start this VM. Now what this gives us the ability to do is make intelligent decisions whenever we have to move a virtual machine or to perform actions on it. So let's say our whole cluster shuts down. We have to start up our virtual machines. Well, now we're going to start our high priority first, then our medium, then our low. So this gives you the ability to do things such as make sure that your infrastructure VMs come on first. If you have domain controllers, DNS, DHCP servers, make those high priority so they come on first. Make your line of business applications medium priority. Your less important apps low priority. And then that fourth option, don't auto start, you can basically use to have a VM stay off if it crashes. This way, it's not going to try to come online and fight for resources as it starts up. And every time you do a live migration, or you drain a node, or you evacuate a host, it's going to do that based on priority order. So we talked about doing that shutdown button, start shutdown. Hey, you still have VMs, we're going to move them for you. It's going to move high priority first, then medium, then low. So we really are trying to treat your VMs based on what you're trying to do with them. Now we had affinity and anti-affinity. Basically what we do here is we force VMs to go to a particular host, separate themselves across different hosts, whatever we really require. Now, the reason why people want this is we've seen over time that they buy newer and newer hardware and keep adding it to their clusters. So you may have a 2003 cluster, then buy new hardware for 2008, put in the same, even newer hardware for 2012. Well, you may have certain VMs or applications that need so much memory that they're not even going to run on your old cluster nodes. So by having this affinity, you can basically enforce a particular VM to always run on a particular node. Now, anti-affinity is going to be used if you want to force the VMs to spread out to avoid a single point of failure. So imagine if you have two virtualized domain controllers. If they're both running on a single host, that host crashes, you've lost both of your VMs. You've lost your domain controller infrastructure. Likewise, if you have a four-node guest cluster, our four VMs in a cluster, that's on a single host, that's a single point of failure. You lose the host, you lose all of your VMs. So you want to think about affinity, anti-affinity anytime you have similar server roles. And basically with anti-affinity, you assign two of the servers the same name, the same tag, and they will purposely spread themselves across the different hosts as much as possible, avoiding these single points of failure. So taking a look at VMware, they do pretty much all of these. These are features that they were ahead of us in the last release. We've been working on to try to catch up, and so we're now delivering them. Now, there's one other feature in here as well that we have that VMware doesn't, and that's guest OS application monitoring. Now, of course, if you have things like VCOPs or you have some of these kind of additional products that aren't built, you know, the add-on products, you can do some monitoring of the actual application. But we're talking about monitoring from the host. What we can now do with Windows Server, when you set up a virtual machine, we can now monitor whether the VM's running. If it crashes, we restart it. We can look within the VM at its actual guest operating system. If that guest OS hangs or there's a blue screen, it crashes, we can restart it. But now we're going one level further, and we're actually looking at the services which are running inside that virtual machine. And so everything that you see in the services when you open your services, that's through Service Control Manager. The host can now monitor each of them, even though they're running inside a VM. So let's say you have maybe a print spooler, a print server, a print spooler service that constantly crashes in your VM. Well, the host can detect that. It can keep restarting it. But if this keeps happening a lot, maybe the problem is because of a bad network connection. So we can actually restart the entire VM. If you still have problems, we can actually move that VM to a different host. Try seeing if it has better network connections over there. So this is just us trying to go through deeper insight, really understanding what's happening to our VMs. Now, as we kind of look at some of the numbers here, maximum nodes in a cluster, we double. Maximum VMs in a cluster, we double. Maximum guest cluster sizes, well, we're actually equal there. But we have it through iSCSI, through Fiber. We're about, 13 times bigger or something. Through file-based guest clusters, not supported. And so our file base would be using something like SMB as your shared storage. Additionally, we support live migration for our guest clusters. So you have your two virtual VMs, we can live migrate it, no downtime. Unfortunately, VMware cannot do that. They have some limitations. So think about that. You've gone and set up a guest cluster, and you can't even move those VMs around. That's a big challenge because that breaks your mobility, that breaks your flexibility of why you would even want to go do a guest cluster in the first place. Now, as we kind of move on, we've added a few more advanced features, some that we're coming first to market with. The one that people are probably most excited about is Hyper-V Replica. Hyper-V Replica is an inbox replication solution for our virtual machines. What we do is basically take a copy every 5 minutes, push it over the network so that you have a backup copy available for a disaster recovery plan inside a different data center. Now, there's been plenty of replication solutions in the past. You can have synchronous, asynchronous, block-based replication, file-based replication. Replication is not a new concept, but it's always required a third-party vendor. We're now providing this in-box for your virtual machines. The way that Hyper-V Replica works is first time you actually say, I want to do a replication, we're going to take a copy of that VHD file. Now, you have the option of actually sending that copy to your second location over a network or loading it onto a thumb drive and physically taking it to your backup location and loading it there if you have a problem with network traffic. What happens then is we keep track of the changes, and every 5 minutes, we send across the change log. We replay it, and we basically rebuild those changes to the VM. So every 5 minutes, we're not copying a VM across the network. We're just copying the delta of the changes through the network. So this basically gives us this nice inbox disaster recovery solution. Now, there are a few downsides. You know, it's not perfect, and the primary problem is it doesn't do synchronous replication. It's all asynchronous. Now, to provide some background, synchronous replication means that you have a transaction at your first site, it writes it to the second site processes it, and it sends an acknowledgement back. This way, you're guaranteed that both sites are in sync. We do not provide this, and if you need this real-time replication, you still will need to work with a third-party vendor. Now, the downside of that synchronous replication is it limits the distance that you can actually have your data centers spread apart, because you've got to send this information over, then wait for an acknowledgement before you process it. That, in turn, actually means that you can often have a performance hit. So high-end SQL applications, they don't work that well with that, because they're constantly waiting for acknowledgements to come back. The downside, of course, with asynchronous replication, and what that is, everything happens at one site every 5 minutes. We pass across the changes. The downside of this is that you could actually lose data. There is a potential for data loss. If you replicated 4 minutes ago, the server crashes, you can potentially lose that 4 minutes of data. So we've had Replica since the 2012 RTM release, but based on feedback from the customers, we've realized that we needed to change our replication frequency. So we now offer replication every 30 seconds, if you're afraid of data loss. We also now offer replication every 15 minutes, if you have expensive network bandwidth. This was a big request, actually, that came out of South Africa, our customers there. They said it's so expensive to use the internet. We don't want replication every 5 minutes. Slow it down. We still need disaster recovery, but we can't do it that frequently. Now, we also extended it with this release to support even a third replication, chained replication. Now, we have the customers that work in large cities like Copenhagen. They have two offices, two data centers in their main city. And so they were doing this replication between data center one to data center two, one to two. But the problem is, if they had a regional power outage or a regional disaster, they would lose both data centers because they were in such a small vicinity. So they said, you know what, we still need additional replication. We want to be able to replicate to a third site as well. Maybe the site's in a different country, hundreds of miles away. So you have this ability to now do close replication as frequently as 30 seconds, and then the long replication every 5 minutes or 15 minutes. So you can have backups of backups for even better disaster recovery, higher resiliency. So as we kind of take a look at, there we go. So we kind of take a look at whether we have replication. There is replication provided with Essentials Plus Edition. We have replication with our basic inbox version. So nice solution. And we have some other advantages of this chained tiered replication as well. So if you kind of take a look at these replication capabilities, they do replication through a virtual appliance. We do this in box. Both do asynchronous replication. We have three different timing options. VMware will allow up to 15 minutes of data loss. We have three sites that we can replicate to. VMware is still on two. And we have different testing capabilities, doing a test failover, planned failover, failback. So a lot of flexibility in how you actually plan for disaster recovery. So as we wrap it up here, and good, we have about 10 minutes left for questions as well. So we wrap it up, you can kind of see these were the main investments that we made in this release. Scalability, security, flexibility, and availability. So hopefully you could see that Microsoft's really trying to just not just go head-to-head with many of these features, but really trying to lead the industry with some of these innovations as well. Now, if you want to learn more, we definitely encourage people to try Hyper-V, download our eval software. We have the Microsoft Virtual Academy, www.microsoftvirtualacademy.com, which actually gives you a lot of training courses, specifically on virtualization for VMware Pros by Microsoft. And so we have courses on here. Everything's free. This is basically an 8-hour course, 8-hour version of what I just presented to you, where we go in-depth through every feature, including demos, including back-and-forth discussion, including answering live questions from a live audience that we did this in front of. So kind of a great way to get almost a more in-depth version of this presentation. We also have another presentation we did, which was a 4-hour presentation of hybrid management, being able to simultaneously manage both VMware and Microsoft environments using System Center 2012. So we look at fabric management with VMM, monitoring with Operations Manager, automation with Orchestrator, and then we even snuck in a module on migration. So if you're thinking about moving from VMware over to Microsoft, looking at the different VM migration tools, such as ones provided by Veeam, the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter, and a V2V conversion, virtual machine conversion, using Virtual Machine Manager. With that, I'm going to wrap it up. I definitely want to encourage you guys to provide feedback on this. But we do have 10 minutes left, so I'd like to open it up to questions. If anybody has a question, you will also get a free T-shirt for Windows Server. So are there any takers? I answered every question you guys had about VMware and Microsoft comparison. I'm sure there's more out there. Yes, question to the front here. Why have we excluded that from what? From Virtual Machine Manager? That's no longer available? Ah, okay, so good. Okay, I get the question here. Sorry about. Here's your t-shirt as well. Woo! If the size doesn't fit, come back to me afterwards. We have different sizes up here. So the question was about different types of migration you can do with our virtual machine manager here. So what I actually have, we could go take a look at this. Here is Windows. This is actually 2012 RTM. This is not the 2012 R2. And within Virtual Machine Manager here, you can go to our VMs. And here we have the ability to go create a new virtual machine, or we can do different types of conversions. And so the different types you have here, well, create a new virtual machine, that's deploy a brand new one. Convert a physical machine means you're going to take some physical server. Could be Windows. Well, actually, it can't be VMware because we can't virtualize that. So it has to be a Windows machine. And we'll actually take it from being a physical server, make it into a Microsoft VM. And then you have this other one here, which is convert a virtual machine. Now, I'm not sure if I have any VMDK files on. Do you guys actually want to see me convert a VMware virtual machine? I can do that. It'll just take me a little minute to set up. Yep. All right, let's do it. I'm kind of put on the spot here with this demo, but I think I can make this work here. So this is built inside Virtual Machine Manager. And basically, what we are going to do is find an offline VMDK file, an offline virtual machine, and go and convert that to a Microsoft virtual machine. So what I'm doing here, I'm taking a look at my library of servers. I have within my library some VHDX files, some SQL scripts, some application tiers, but I don't have any VMDK files yet. I think I know where those are stored. So I'm going to go lab program files. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to search for my .vmdk. That's going to find what I need. And so basically what we do as part of this VMware conversion, we figure out what the different parts of a virtual machine are for VMware and for Hyper-V, and we basically do a mapping between these two. Here we go. So what we're actually going to do is go and read the metadata from a VMware virtual machine, things such as the amount of memory, the amount of the number of virtual networks, the name of those virtual networks, things that could be translated to our world. And we just basically remap them inside our virtual machine configuration file. So 2 gigs of memory there equals 2 gigs of memory here. We then have a built-in converter that does a VMDK file to a VHDX file. And so we'll actually rebuild that file structure. Then we have our metadata, our configuration. We have our disk, put it together, and that goes and creates our new virtual machine. Okay, so here's our VMDK files. Okay, you know what? I just cannot find my VMDK files, but I do have a click-through demo I can show you instead that does the exact same thing here. So if you just hang on 1 second. Export. Convert. Here somewhere. All right. VMM install management pack. Man, I'm sorry. I am failing you here. I'm sorry. I just can't find this demo that I have here. So my apologies. If you want to stay around afterwards, I'll do that. But I want to try to take some more time with audience questions rather than struggle through that there. Question up here. How does it save you any what? Oh, so the question is, how does a 15-minute replication window save you data, save you traffic? So it's just basically the frequency. So rather than sending the data every 5 minutes, using the network every 5 minutes, we're just sending it every 15 minutes. Now, if you have, 3 times the amount of change within that 15-minute period, you're not really going to get much benefit, but it's just less frequency, so there's less processing, less frequency of the network traffic. So I guess it's more, instead of having small bursts, it's less frequent large bursts. That still earns you a t-shirt. I don't think I can throw that farther. yes, question. So the question is, in VMware, you could go and add USB devices, connect them to virtual machines. I know you were talking about actually being able to pass through and read a USB device from a VM. You're not talking about booting from a USB, right? Okay. So the question is, if you have something on your USB stick, such as a licensing token, and that needs to connect to your virtual machine, can you do that with Hyper-V? Yes, you can, but there's a third-party product that's used. I forget the name of it, but it is a free download, and basically that will go and connect your USB drive, do pass through to the VM. So we don't provide that in box, but there is a third-party tool that will do that. And it's free. Any other questions? If I'm missing anybody, yell. Yes. Are you looking at having one site or two sites? Okay, so the question is, what's the recommendation in a single site? Should I have one large cluster with 40 nodes or two smaller clusters with 20 nodes? What are the trade-offs? What are the benefits? I would recommend having a single cluster with 40 nodes because it's a single point of management. Having two clusters means you have two network names, two objects. You just have two things that you're trying to manage. By having larger clusters, it's going to give you more flexibility to move VMs between the clusters. So by having a larger cluster, you essentially have more endpoints, more options, but it's still kind of a single management point. Beyond that, not really a whole lot of benefit going one way or another. The reason why I asked about sites was because if you have two sites, two different locations, and you want to use Hyper-V Replica, you have to have a cluster on each site. So the way Hyper-V Replica works in a cluster, it actually has a highly available replication engine. It's called the Hyper-V Replica Broker. So the way you want to think about that is this actual replication service for the replica, we make highly available as well. So just like a VM that will fail over, move between these different nodes with crashes, so will this replication broker. And so this means that it will always be available so long as your cluster's up. And so it will always replicate the VMs. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because we have this single replication engine in a cluster, it cannot replicate within a cluster. It can only replicate from one cluster to a standalone, a cluster to a cluster, standalone to standalone, standalone to cluster. So now if you have a two different locations, you want to use Hyper-V Replica, you go and put a cluster on each of those locations. Each of those clusters has this highly available replication engine, and those two replication engines talk to each other. That's all I got on that. Yes? So the question is, if we are setting up a new Hyper-V 2012 R2 cluster, would you use SMB or would you use cluster shared volumes? Actually, you use both. Cluster shared volumes is an option that's supported on SMB. So you could really kind of get best of both worlds. But what we actually do now, we kind of changed our whole cluster topology here. I'm actually going to quickly pull up the session I did yesterday, because you can actually use the scale-out file clusters that you're referring to as a different layer of high availability. So what I'm pulling up here is the presentation on Hyper-V optimization on a cluster. And so as we kind of look at cluster planning now, we actually have availability on six different layers to get the most highly resilient system possible. And so what you're most traditionally used to is this, we have hardware high availability. That's things such as MPIO, NIC team, and things like that. But then we have host clustering. That's what you're kind of used to, the traditional cluster. We then have guest clustering, which is we talked about having the VMs fail over between the VMs. But what we can now do as well is have actual high availability for VMs running over SMB connections. Now, an SMB connection is a server message block. It's a protocol Microsoft developed, worked with a lot of industry standards. And it's basically what we use to speak with file shares. So when you create a file share, you access it, copy data, you're going over, you're using the SMB protocol. And so with this release, we kind of thought about shared storage a little more. You know, shared storage meaning fiber channel, serial attached, SCSI, iSCSI. And we said, what is a file share versus what's shared storage? Well, if you have two servers that are accessing the same file share, they can see the same disk. Isn't that basically a type of shared storage? And so this is the Hyper-V over SMB. We allow you to actually use a regular file share to store your Hyper-V virtual machines. So instead of saying, I want to deploy my VM to C/virtual machines, you can say, I want to deploy my VM to whack my share, store it over there. So we supported clusters using SMB file shares for the virtual machine. But the reason why this is important, and I wanted to bring this up, is the way that these scale-out file servers work over SMB is they use cluster shared volumes as well. What this means is we have a single cluster shared volume disk. We have multiple file servers that are all pointing to that same disk. Now, the way that we actually implement this is we go and put our client access point, whack my share, or whack scale out file server, across multiple different file servers as part of this file server cluster. Now, what this means is when somebody says, I want to use my this VM that's on this CSV disk, well, VM1 will go through server 1, VM2, server 2, VM3, server 3. So we're kind of distributing the traffic of all these VMs that are going to the same disk. The other big advantage of this is this gives you another level of resiliency. Let's say that one of these file servers crashed here. Even though somebody, the VM, couldn't access its disk through that connection, the running VM will actually redirect, go to a different server, and then back to the file share. So basically, by having these file share locations spread out across different physical servers, when one server crashes, we can dynamically redirect access, and so our VMs can stay running. They're still using the scale-out file server on a CSV disk on the back end. So it's basically providing super multipath I/O, different points towards the single file server. How am I doing on time? I am now 2 minutes over, so thank you all for attending. It's been really good. I hope you learned a lot. Hope you have a better understanding of how to compare our technologies. I'm told I need to get out of the room quickly because the movies are going to start, but I'll stay around the hallway right by the door. If you have any other questions, comments, if I owe you a t-shirt, please come find me in 2 minutes right outside the door. I'd love to keep discussing VMware and Hyper-V with you. Thank you.